everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Wonderful new marriage. A wonderful, wonderful thing. Love. One of the strangest things in the world is to have a relationship, we know. And part of having a relationship is sometimes dealing with a mate that doesn't seem to be completely rational. Today, I'm going to investigate two phenomena. One is irrationality, and the other is over-emotionality or overreaction. What is an overreaction? I was looking at the moon cycle. The term moon cycle or lunar cycle refers to the moon's continuous orbit around the Earth. Of course, this doesn't really have to do with anything. However, according to the moon, just in case you didn't know, the first moon is called the new moon. It's not visible. Then comes the waxing crescent. Then comes the waxing gibbous, G-I-B-B-O-U-S. I bet you didn't know that that was a phase of the moon. It's like something like three-quarters of the moon. Then there's the full moon. Then there's the waning gibbous, G-I-B-B-O-U-S, which means the three-quarter moon on the other side. Then there's a third-quarter moon, which is a half moon. But the illuminated part is opposite the first quarter. And then there's the waning crescent. Now, that's the little crescent, right, as the moon turns from the old moon to the new moon, even though it's the same moon, you know. Over and over again, we don't have new moons. What does the moon have to do with anything? Well, you know, astrology certainly picked up on the fact that moon is going to affect people, the time of day a person's born, what's happening in their lives, the pressures, gravity, whatever it is. Something affects people in some strange way. You know, there's a full moon out there tonight, says the policeman to his associate. Oh, yeah, okay, let's get ready. It's a full moon. Maybe there is no such thing. Maybe there is no such thing as people being over-emotional, over-reactive, over-impulsive. Or maybe there is. Well, we certainly know that there are certain biological phenomena that could make you feel hypersensitive. You know, stay up all night without any sleep. And you're going to be weird when you react to things eventually. Drink too much coffee. Drink too much alcohol, be in certain cycles of the month, or even watching your children grow up as they go through adolescence. You know, the teenage years, the hypersensitive 12-year-old daughter who is hysterical. Well, what is this thing? What is this over-emotionality? What is it? See, here's the problem when you love somebody and they have a very big emotional reaction. It's not like they're your child and, you know, your kid. You say to your kid, well, you know, here's a big reaction. So it's only a big reaction. You'll get through it. Don't worry. We'll calm down. Because when you're with somebody else and that somebody is a partner, they lay their emotional reaction at your feet. They point it right to you. They say, you. You did this and you did that and you made me feel the way I did. I do. And you, if you're a loving person, you listen and you say, what did I do? And they said, well, you said this word. And you say, oh, I didn't mean that. And then you start to defend yourself. And then suddenly you notice that another you comes at you and another attack comes at you and you wonder what's going on. And then it keeps boiling and boiling. And you say to yourself, how do I get out of this mess? What do I do? I'll apologize. I'll try to browbeat the person. I'll try to rationalize with them. I'll try to talk to them. I'll help them relax. I'll punch them in the nose. I don't know what I'm going to do. So we all have to deal with hyper-emotionality and the lack of reason. And I am not the voice of reason. I'm not somebody who says that reason makes it work, because I know it doesn't make it work. If somebody's on a tear, they're on a tear. So I was talking, I was doing some research on this, and I realized that there's a great deal that has to do with modern television. Modern television has been, I'm just appreciating how deep it goes. On, it's reality TV, they call it. But in reality TV, what is the key item that we're looking for in reality TV is we're looking for overreactions. We are looking, they have one called Bridezilla. And in Bridezilla, you're looking for the worst potential bride. You want people who are screaming and yelling and angry. Angry Americans. We want to see people who are reduced to just probably primitive kind of emotional states. We want to see it on TV, and the more that you can present it on TV, they call it reality TV, but the coaching is hyped, you know, hype up your emotions, have more emotions. I was watching a thing called Cash Cab. It's a little thing on TV that's cute because it's a word, it's a game. But in this TV thing, I noticed that the people have these overreactions in the cab. They're whooping it up every time they get something right. And I'm saying, wait a minute, you mean they get coached before they get in the cab to have a big reaction or you're not allowed in? I remember going to a couple of rated TV shows where they tell you beforehand that when the man comes out, when Jon Stewart comes out on stage, you have to really whoop it up. You got to scream, and that's what makes you a good audience. So they want over-emotionality. Over-emotionality is what sells. It's something, it does something for people. What does it do? Why do we want it? Why does it sell television? Well, there's a reason. Because over-emotionality sets your body in motion, and you will buy the products advertised if what you see on television is hyper-emotional. You're more likely to buy the products advertised if you view something hyper-emotional. You would not buy the products on the Yoga Buddha show. You know what I mean? I mean, if they were trying to sell you something in between doing a meditation show, you're not going to buy anything. Okay, here's meditation. Then at the end of this, okay, now we're going to take a little break. And what do we have to sell you? Well, whatever they have to sell you, unless they're selling you something like bells, you're not going to buy it, because there's no push, because there's no emotionality, because there's no fire inside you. There's nothing inside you looking to. So society capitalizes on overreactions. A lot of Wall Street pundits, a lot of people in Wall Street who are really sharp traders of the stock market, they make their money on overreactions of the public. When there is a big emotional swing, when there's a big swing and the stock market goes down like it did in 08, when the stock market went down through the floor and people had their accounts all filled with preferred stocks from banks, and then these preferred stocks kept dropping in price, and this is your retirement fund. And I know so many people who bailed out, who sold out somewhere during that pressure. So here it is, 08. They're getting 50 cents on a dollar, but they're being told the prices are getting worse and worse. And so they sell out. They sell out. They can't. They sell it into the market. Then the market went lower. They felt justified. And then the banks bought all of those stocks that the public sold. Because capitalizing on panic always works. See, people want to sell their houses because they can't get out of their houses, and buy up all the houses. People want to sell their stocks because they're in panic, buy up all the stocks. Over-emotionality is to be capitalized on, manipulated. That's from the big picture. But from the up-close picture, it's brutal. Now, I've asked, so I'm doing some research about this, and I was looking at what happens in different parts of the world. And I'm very lucky to have working with me Thelma Wingate. Thelma works as my office manager, but has experience as a home care supervisor, and she's worked with home care. She's worked with different HR groups. And what she's had to do is manage people's emotional reactions. Thelma, welcome to WBAI.
Hi.
And you're, this is your first time you've ever been on air, right?
Yes, this is the first time.
And Thelma's been working. How long is it now you've been working
with us? One month.
Isn't it interesting?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Thelma, when you teach, you usually get two people, right?
Yes.
You'll get a person who is a, what are they, students or somebody who's a home health care provider?
Yes, home health care provider.
Providing who?
The client, patient in home.
And the patients in their home, are they usually elderly?
Yes, in most cases.
And sometimes they are dementia.
Yes, quite often.
Do they get emotional, people with dementia?
Absolutely. It's various stages of it, especially in the beginning, when at onset, there's more emotion involved at that time, because usually they haven't been diagnosed yet, and we don't quite know what's going on, and there's flare-ups all the time. So it can be very difficult.
So what do you teach people about handling those flare-ups? Because there you got somebody on the other side. They're not going to be rational.
Well, I've had that type of situation many times. What I would teach the aides, first of all, was patience. You're in the client's home. You have to respect the home. The client has flare-ups. You can't retaliate. You can't yell. You can't go back at them. We have to understand that it's an illness in most cases, and you back down when the client is flaring. You can't go toe-to-toe with them because it's just going to escalate. So I would encourage the aide to back down. I would often get calls in the middle of a flare-up, and I could hear the client screaming in the background, and I would try to calm the aide to hopefully, you know, calm the situation down. And usually if they back down or even left the room, if they could, without endangering, you know, the patient's well-being, usually the situation would settle down to a degree.
Now imagine having that very same thing happen with your mate, right? Now you're married and you have a husband or wife who's having the same reaction. You would advise the same thing, right? Calm down, don't react. They're screaming, they're yelling, but the trouble is they're accusing you. And it's very hard. It's a very different thing up close, isn't it?
Very different. Very different.
When you've had the kind of situations, even in HR, you know, where you've had other things other than the, in recruitment, do you look for emotionality in the people that you're looking for? I mean, how do you treat, as a possible hiring person, how do you treat someone when you see them as very emotional?
During the hiring, the screening process, those were things I would look for. In some cases, someone who was sort of fit into that category, they would work well in certain situations where we had a depressed client who didn't want to get out of bed, who wanted the shades drawn every day. Those personalities would help, you know, pull the client out of bed and, you know, get them up and doing a few things. So in some cases, it worked to their advantage that way. I would not place that type of highly strong emotional person on a client who's in that, you know, has that same type of personality, because it's going to be a war from the moment they walk in.
So that's very interesting. You see, now there you are validating my point that there's a chemical reaction that gets due. And so if you take somebody who's high strung and you put them with somebody who's low strung, they may find a balance, right? It's not that you can't use that high strung person. But if you find somebody who's high strung and you put them with somebody else who's high strung, watch out. It's not going to work. Thank you very much, Thelma. We may have more questions about this to ask you, but I appreciate it. And I know this is your initiation, and you've been great.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. So let's talk more about that. So then there it happens, both when you're being hired, in love relationships. You know, it's very difficult because you have no, what do you do? Let's take a look at some of the major emotional reactions that people have. You can have one of six kind of emotional reactions. A person can react with fear. That could be a major emotional reaction. What's a good example of that? Fear. So somebody, you hear a noise and you jump through your skin. Right? That's one. Fear. You overreact. You get tense. You can't calm down. Anger is another common one. Now, you know, anger is kind of an interesting thing. The angry overreaction probably is the most difficult one because, once again, I want you to know that you are usually the person. If you're in love with someone, you become the target. And when you become the target, it's very hard to step outside of it. So someone else's anger directed at you is brutal. Because especially if you love them, right? Now, what do? You're going to take space. You're not going to say anything. Guilt is another overreaction. Some people have this tremendous amount of guilt. And it's like, it's just too much guilt. Grief. I know somebody who actually uses 9/11 as a kind of a holiday. Not that it's a holiday that they're celebrating, but they light candles for 9/11. And they pick anything that is somebody else's sadness and make it their own. And they overreact with grief. You know, oh, look at that. And I could actually weep over that. You know what I mean? Sadness can be an overreaction. You could have just too much sadness. Now, what is sadness? Sadness is always the result of something that is lost. So if you're sad, you could ask yourself a question, what did I lose? So obviously, if a person is an overreaction and the overreaction is perpetual sadness, a sadness that won't stop, they perceive they lost something that they can't get back. Helplessness, another overreaction. You become debilitated. You can't move. You just feel powerless completely. Or there's one other emotional reaction that happens, an overreaction, which is numbing. You go numb. You can't be touched. You like live in a blank world. I think I've felt every one of these things in my life where, you know, I've been frightened. I don't remember that one as big, but angry for sure. Grief for sure, sadness for sure, helplessness, powerlessness, and emotional numbing, all of those. So if you grew up and you grew up in a tough world, look, you've had to deal with something, my friends. You've had to deal with the fact that you have a brain that has given you a lot of emotions, and you have a lot of emotions, but it's just not easy to get by with these. You can't feel them. Most families tell kids, don't feel, think. And you're taught to use your brain to control your feelings. But that doesn't sit very well with the feelings inside you because sometimes they explode. And when you're somebody who always tries to control your feelings through thinking, when you have an emotional overreaction, you have one of these logical, perpetual, rapid-fire, logical kind of arguments. You did this, that, blah, 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 you, and then evidence, and then courtroom, and then bringing back stuff from the past, and then last week you said, and then you said this, and then I said that. And so you try to reason with it because it sounds reasonable. You say, but I didn't do that, or I told you about that, or I apologize for that. Yes, but, and you. Okay. So one would think that with enough therapy, enough self-awareness, a person would eventually not do this. Well, it's not true, and we figured out why. Let's go back to some of the biochemistry. Brain mapping shows us that that little pea-sized thing in the middle of our brain, the amygdala, it lights up when it is perceived, when it's activated by a perceived danger or another trigger. Areas of the brain that are responsible for judgment, self-awareness, long-term memory also light up And when they are activated, the amygdala diminishes. But in an overreaction, the amygdala is the only part of the brain that is active. Now, that's very significant. And it shuts off through the hippocampus. It shuts off the function of the rest of the brain. So here's what happens to you, okay? Let's think about amygdala, what amygdala is. The amygdala is the seat. It's your survival mechanism. It's the seat of your fight-flight reaction. You're either going to run or you're going to fight, right? So it's fight, flee, or freeze, which is another thing, part of the amygdala. The amygdala has three tools. Either beat the thing up, either run away, or freeze in your spot. And these are the emotional reactions that people have. Now, what is it about that? Why? The amygdala, because it perceives threat. Once it gets into that, it fires and it shuts off all the higher functions. Therefore, you cannot use what you learned. Therefore, therapists have as many fights and get as crazy as anybody else. Because if they get locked into one of these battles, they're gone. They're just gone. The amygdala takes over and it fires. Now, some people don't have that happening. But the very emotional type of person generally tends to lose, or the very unemotional, logical kind of person, both extremes, tend to lose access to the higher brain and get sometimes stuck on the amygdala. And it's fascinating stuff to know. The standard for what constitutes an overreaction seems to change because strong reactions get the most reaction in many ways, because there is one more overreaction that I haven't mentioned. Love. Love is an overreaction very often. Very often a person will go and say, my love, and the love dominates everything, and the love gets to be, you know, you meet somebody for the first time, you know, and you for the very first time, you fall in love. What is that? And then, of course, as soon as you do, think of this. The amygdala takes over. You lose all your higher functions. And now you no longer have a brain to think with. So when we see people who are that enamored, that involved in a loving kind of way, they've lost their mind. Just like people who are being over-emotional and overreactive, they lose their mind. And when I say lose your mind, it means exactly that. You lose the higher cortical functions, the ones that tell you, don't be so serious. Don't, you know, take it easy. Back off. Relax. Look at this person. Because in all truth, once you identify that your partner is out of their mind, and when I say out of their mind, meaning they are out of their rational mind, they are instead in their amygdalic mind. You know, once you realize, after you've been in the argument for more than 20 minutes, and I can guarantee you, you could judge it, 20 minutes of any discussion, even if it's heated, if it goes beyond 20 minutes and it perpetuates, that's it. Somebody's gone. Because between two humans, if they have a disagreement, 20 minutes will cover just about anything. If you talk to somebody for 20 minutes and they don't get, the conversation doesn't get better within 20 minutes, if it's not working towards getting better, forget it. It means it's just going to go downhill, and it usually does. Because usually with the amygdala, there's a point where the person has to destroy themselves. The person who is having the reaction has to eat their own heart out. First, they got to get you to be alienated from them. First, they got to push you away. And then when you finally give up, when you finally get it, hey, this isn't real. This isn't about me. And you walk away. When you finally do that, then they burrow in and they go inside and they dig all the way down and they get so unhappy. And they think about you and how it's your fault and how you're no good. And then they blame themselves about how they're no good. None of this counts. It's the amygdala at work trying to burn itself off, because what the amygdala is looking for is it's looking for enough pain so that a person could give themselves a flood of endorphins. What good are endorphins? Well, endorphins feel good. That's that kind of opiate-like hormone that we have, that if you give yourself enough pain, which you could do emotionally, you eventually get flooded with the hormone in the endorphins. When you get flooded with the endorphins, a funny thing happens. The hippocampus allows the higher brain to function. Now, the interesting way about getting flooded with the endorphins is the best path in is to cry. When a person is hysterical, overreacting, screaming, yelling, you'll notice the tears are missing. There may be tears at the corner of their eyes. But if they just wept, then it would happen. Then they would feel the endorphins flooding, the tears would provide the release, the pressure would come off, and they would be able to come down and get their higher functions back. Now, that doesn't mean you're off the hook, because you may have been a real bum. You may have made some mistakes. You may be punishable for what you're doing. But the overreaction is not going to get you there to a reasonable place where you could talk. So, my friends, no matter what you see on television, no matter what you see in the television world about telling you over and over again that, you know, or kind of hype emotionality, and everywhere you go, they're hyping emotionality and they're making you more emotional and kind of idealizing it in some kind of way. And you look at freaky people and you admire them and you think, oh, it must be wonderful to be so loose and so free. Don't believe it. There's a place where we're looking for peace. There's a place that we all want to go to where we could be calm, and we want to be somewhere at Shibumi. We want to be at the place where we could feel ourselves relaxed, calm, loving, but not attached to all the pain. You know, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I hope that makes sense to you. I have a sneaking suspicion that we are going to have many people replaying this program today, because most people I know who I deal with who talk to me about their mates talk about either theirs or their mates' overreactions. Now, when a person comes to therapy, they tell their therapist about their overreactions, but they justify them. They blame their husbands. They blame their wives. She, he, he. And if the therapist wants to keep earning money for doing nothing, they validate it. They say, oh, why didn't you talk to him about it? Maybe you should bring him in for more therapy. You know what I mean? They don't tell you, hey, hold on, what's all this he-she stuff? What about the I stuff? Where were you at that moment? And can we find a better way for you to get hold of yourself? Is there a better way for me to get you that you could eventually find your own heart again when you're in the middle of this turmoil? But that's what a therapist would do. That's what a friend would do. That's what good family would do. But unfortunately, when you're stuck with just that other person, it's very hard to do it when you are the attackee. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little more and your phone calls at 212-209-2900. We'll be right back. And this is Armand DeMille back with you at The Positive Mind. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We're talking today about emotional reactions. My associate, Lauren, brought something to my attention I thought really worthwhile. Let's take mention of this. Lauren, what was that you were talking about? Hold on a second. There you go.
Well, in terms of overreacting and logically thinking, I have an intense phobia and anxiety towards mice. Logically, they're tiny creatures. I know they can't hurt me, but the second I see or have an inkling that a mouse is around me, I completely freak out.
Now, when you freak out, though, what happens to you?
I immediately scream. My initial reaction is screaming and running from it.
And running from wherever the area is.
Yes.
Okay. And so now we have fight and we have flee, right? You don't get aggressive. You don't go get it. You don't say, give me a gun, I'll go get that mouse.
No.
No, you just run, which is very natural. And now that you run and you're in that amygdala reaction, mm-hmm. which is true of all phobias, by the way, mm-hmm. you don't have your higher brain. And you're a very smart person. You're one of the smartest people I ever met. So you have all this brain that tells you there's nothing there. It's just a little mouse.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter, right?
It's not just the actual mouse. It's all the connotations with mice. You know, dirty. When there's one mouse, there's mice. It's not just one mouse. So I just start thinking of all these added, these added assumptions, even though it's just a mouse in front of me. But I just start, my brain just starts going.
So it goes into greater dangers, infections, infestations, mm-hmm. all that other stuff. I know somebody who has such a fear of mice that when Apple came out with their computer, she had to call the thing that you move, she called it a mini instead of a mouse, right? And nobody was allowed to say the word mouse in her house. I know. And she got everybody to do it. Nobody could say the word mouse. Oh, don't say mouse. Okay. Now, but Lauren, it goes further than that. How did your family deal with your fear?
And, you know, my parents' reaction to me was, Lauren, it's just a little mouse. What are you getting so upset about? You're bigger than it. There's no reason to be upset. If anything, the mouse is more scared of you than you are of it. So definitely didn't coddle me in terms of mice.
In fact, quite the opposite.
Exactly.
Quite the opposite. Had they put their arm around you and said, oh, kitty, I know how scared you are. I'm a little scared, too. But I'm going to make sure the mouse doesn't hurt you. And you go through it as much. And I'm going to hold you while until your fear passes. Had they done that, this fear would no longer be there. You know?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Other brain imaging studies have shown how religious ceremonies with strong sensory input, like drumming, dancing, and such, they find a 180-degree path to stillness. In essence, during the ceremonial intensity, the emotional seat goes haywire, so much so that the hippocampus also shuts off further input to the area. So the result of this is a meditative hypnotic state that's induced by religious ceremony. So remember, we have fight, flight, or freeze. And the hypnosis is a form of freeze, in which case we could sell you just about anything. You know, we get you in that shock state that seems like a religious, they call it a state of grace. Boy, it's okay. I mean, if you don't know, harm comes to you, and that's what you like. That's one way. Okay. The other part about emotionality that's important is that one person's emotion differs quite differently in physical symptoms than another person's. Like one person who feels anger can get a headache from their anger, while another person can sweat. So it is very hard to, number one, communicate what you're feeling, and then to be told that you're not feeling it right. That's another problem. Somebody telling you, oh, you're not feeling it right. 212-209-2900. That's our number here. I don't know if anybody in the world has ever had to deal with this. I'm sure you have. When a person is in emotional overreaction and they're functioning highly on their amygdala, you're going to see that they have to run, that they want to get out of there. That's one of the things. They want to get out of there. They got to get away. Very often these people are attracted to running as a way, because running is just the command of the amygdala. And they say, oh, when I run, it's wonderful. I feel fabulous. That's pure amygdala functioning, telling you this is the way you get back to your brain, because you run, you get the endorphins, your amygdala calms down, and you wind up being back to your rational brain. Trouble with running is it doesn't solve the problem. It just kind of perpetuates it. However, when a person is dealing with this hypersensitive thing, they can't hear very well. So advice such as calm down, take it easy. What are you overreacting about? It just don't work. The best thing you could do, my friend, if you have the nerve to, is remove yourself. If you can't, if the person won't let you embrace them, if the person won't let you just stay in place, if the person doesn't say, no, I'm going to be with you even though you're so upset, even with me, then the only thing you could do is remove yourself. But it takes a lot of courage to remove yourself when a person is threatening to abandon you, because part of what they always do is they threaten to leave you for life. See, now it's, I'm going to leave you, and they throw that in because it's everything possible to hook you into staying there to be a part of this violent exchange. But it's not that they're wrong for doing it. They're trapped. I would rather be me than them anytime, because the person who's going through it is going through torture. Torture. It is horrible. In the privacy of their own homes, they feel such pain. It's so terrible. You know, they feel reduced to nothing. And it's like, until it passes. 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Yes, Armand, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon.
This conversation is such a timely topic for me personally, because I am definitely going through a situation with my mate that has been going on for several years. I've spoken to you before about it, but I don't want to get into detail too much. And it's a process of overreaction and my underreaction to a situation. And the underreaction in my situation came on my part, and the overreaction came on my wife's part. And so far now, it has driven us apart. And the overreaction was because of my wife's early trauma in life about a certain situation. You know, she was abused early on in her life. And I didn't, because I don't have that, I have the sympathy, but I don't have the empathy in the situation where I can relate in the same way. Her reaction, now I'm realizing, is totally justified based on the situation. But it's still, when you look at it in a rational way, it's hard to look at it and say, hey, you're doing the right thing. And it's hard not to go back and forth with blame. You know what I mean?
It's hard not to go back and forth with blame. Let's go back to this for a minute. If a person has an early childhood experience that results in them having a panicky kind of feeling, that should be dealt with therapeutically, and that should be gone. That doesn't last very many years if they get a good therapy for it. If it perpetuates, very often we find a reason, we find something to hook on, and we keep it present in our mind so that we could go over it again and again and again and again, because we're firing up the amygdala, we're losing our brain. It's the only way we can get the energy out there.
And now,
I see your method, your personal method, is to try to put out the fire. But don't you get it by now? It's a trick.
Of course, and I'm seeing it play out, because it is. My wife actually happens to be a psychotherapist. Believe it or not,
some of the most hysterical people I know.
Okay, so what I'm saying is, it was something that I expected her to use a higher functioning part of her brain, because we've discussed it so many times, and I thought that the fire was out, and I thought that it could be handled, and the situation became so. I think that she's so attached to the trauma, and it's almost a way of self-medicating. I don't know.
That's a very good point. Now, wait a minute. Get this. You're saying something important. It is a way of self-medicating. See, so let's say you take the childhood trauma of being either terrorized by mice, which is just the equivalent, or having an early childhood abuse of some kind, and you put it in a little pocket on a movie reel somewhere in your mind. And then every time you're getting a little depressed, instead of getting depressed, you play the movie reel and you go into panic. Mm-hmm. Now you go into panic and you shut off memory functions, you shut off a lot of other functions, and you become, in effect, a chemical mess, but you're firing up the engine, firing up the engine, and eventually it gets so bad that it gets to the tears, it gets to all that stuff, and then it gets to eventually back to the feeling love again. So it's almost like it's a fix.
It is, and I've seen it replay itself. It's just that right now, because it is in such a chronic state, that it seems almost irreparable, because my wife is now in a state where I feel like I want to go and seek Alzheimer's counseling, because I don't know this person. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear what you're
saying. Locked down in such a way that she's totally lost the kind of connection that we had for...
How old is she? Could she be...
Yeah, we've spoken about the perimenopause.
Menopause, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah,
perimenopause and menopause is something that will lock you in for a while.
Yeah,
and it takes quite a man to say, I see this as perimenopausal. I'm going to stick with you till you go through it, because it could last as long as 10 years.
Yeah, I know.
You know what I mean? And I don't know. I don't know if we're supposed to stay in there or not supposed to. I looked at a headline in a newspaper today. AMPM had a newspaper out there, and it said, people are no longer getting married. The reduction in the number of marriages is enormous.
Well, yeah, I could see why, especially, I mean, if you know, people are anticipating these type of things in their later years. And I always look at these couples that, you know, have been, you know, 50, 60 years of marriage, and maybe because they didn't have all that information at their disposal, just made them stick it out, regardless. You know, with all the information that we're having, you know, we're having, like, second thoughts in terms of going ahead and pushing through this stuff. You know,
we should have 7-year renewable contracts. They should be renewable by mail, which means the following. If both people don't mail it in, the marriage is dissolved.
Null and void.
That's all. It's that simple. If you have a card, if you mail it in, both of you mail it in and they receive it, you're married.
Hey, listen, that sounds like a good idea, Armand. And I tell you something, you should put that up on your website.
Okay, I think we'll do that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Armand, how you doing? It's Marcus from Brooklyn.
Hi there, Marcus.
How are you? I'm calling because I wanted to ask you. I had just recently left a job. I had two branches. They were competing with one another. I was in one of the branches and was getting the pressure of pulling up more productivity. They were telling me I was doing good, but every 5 seconds they're on top of me that I'm doing something wrong. So I finally just walked out of there. You think I was right? I mean, I felt really like the pressure they were putting me on was like, I can't work like that, you know? So I walked out. Was that a good thing to do, maybe,
well,
perhaps?
Here we go. Look, Marcus.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you something. Do you feel bad about having left?
Not so much as I'm in a situation that I need the money.
Yeah, you need the money, right?
I need
so
the money, right?
To walk out on jobs.
And so that was not a cool thing to do.
Okay.
But at the same
let me tell you about it, okay? You're a man who has had much, and I could tell just from your voice, Marcus.
Right.
You've had a rough life.
Well, I've spoken to you before.
Okay, so you've been stepped on a number of times.
More than a number of times.
But you don't take it very well anymore. And you've gotten to a point where you have this part of you that is just saying, no, I won't do it. No, I won't do it.
Right.
And, you know, I can't help but sympathize with the fact that sometimes it's just going to be too much for you. You're going to have problems with authority right and left. Wherever there's a superior over you, you're going to have an automatic problem with them.
Right.
So what you need to do is find some kind of work where you're not so accountable immediately to somebody, like driving a cab or something like that, where you can be responsible to yourself, except then you got to deal with drivers.
No, but here's the thing. I do not have a problem working with people.
Yeah, no, not with people.
Or having somebody working over me. That's not my issue. The issue was... They I was doing a phone survey.
But they were finding fault with
and,
you.
And with no, actually, on their report, they wrote I was doing great. But I couldn't understand why every 5 seconds they're on top of me telling me this and that, but they're writing me up as doing great.
Okay, so let me ask you, Marcus. So, go back in your family.
Right.
Go back in your family.
Not only we have one, just my mother.
Okay, your mother. And tell me about how your mother would pick on you in the same kind of way and ask you to do better and do better and do better.
The only thing she did that with me with was school, mainly.
Yeah, right.
But I actually didn't take offense to that so much because I had all the other elements around me, advising me to do the same thing.
Yeah, I hear. Marcus, you sound like a good man. You're a delicate guy. And you're going to find your way. You're going to find your way. And eventually you'll find that your skin gets a little thicker and you don't react as strongly and you don't walk out on jobs. But you find a different way of doing it, you know?
Right.
But
that was my thing. Right?
In the meantime, you are who you are. And I respect you for it.
No, thank you. Same here. That was my thing. Like, you know.
I got you.
Hey, take care. And thanks a lot, Amon.
Thanks
you're the
for
best,
calling
brother.
In. Sure.
Take care.
212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is my first time calling.
Congratulations on calling.
Thank you very much. My situation is this. I'm in a relationship with this guy he's going through a divorce now. They've been separated for some time. But every time he speaks with his wife, then afterwards, we always seems to have a little fight or some tension between us. I'm wondering if he's convinced of his decision to be with me, or if he's wondering if he made the right decision.
Well, I'm sure you've asked him about that, right?
Yes, I've asked him about that.
And what does he say?
He's convinced he wants to be with me.
And so why does he have this very negative reaction after he talks to his wife? Does he talk to his wife when you're there?
Sometimes, no, but sometimes I'll know that he gets the call.
You mean he gets the call? He gets a call from his wife when he's with you, and he answers the phone?
Yes. You know, they have children together, so they have to speak.
But he's separating with his wife. He doesn't have to answer phones. He could take messages and call her back when he's not with you. You know what I mean? So it's kind of a trap that you're there and he has to pick up the phone when you're with your man and he's taking calls from his wife. Why is he taking the call? Why doesn't she leave him a message and then he'll call her back?
Okay, but even sometimes I am not there, but I can tell from his action that, you know, maybe he had spoke to her earlier during the day or something, but I know that
it's true. What's your name, by the way?
Can I give a fake name?
Sure you can.
Elisa,
that's a nice name to pick, Elisa. You know, Elisa, you sound like a sensitive person, and you're probably absolutely right. And if he is separating, maybe there is a lot of pain of separating. Maybe it's difficult for him, and maybe you're watching him go through this emotional big reaction of leaving his wife. And if you know that he's absolutely leaving, how do you know for a fact that he is leaving, by the way?
Because we had spoke about it before he did, and I told him that, you know, if we go out...
But has he told his wife that he's leaving?
Yes, they're going through the divorce.
How are they going through that? Has he left the house yet?
Yeah, they left the house more than 2 years now.
Okay, so he's out of the house.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that divorce process can be very difficult, let me tell you. And it gets all kinds of funny stuff gets brought up in it. And maybe he needs to go through this pain while he separates, and he may not know it. But, you know, if what you're saying, Elisa, is right, eventually you'll see it and you won't take it to heart. As long as he doesn't aim it at you, you can sit through it. You could watch it. You could just don't argue with him about it. Just say, I see you going through this. I'll be here, you know? As long as he's not aiming at you. But it does not mean that he's made the wrong choice, that he's showing ambivalence about his choice with you. It means that he's having an emotional reaction.
Okay,
Thank you. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you very much.
Sure. 212-209-2900. We have time for one more call. Let's take one more call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to contribute to this discussion concerning phobias and to make mention of a therapy known as past life regression and how for many people, and I can personally attest to its efficacy, not that I had a phobia, but I've witnessed this in people, how by undergoing a hypnotherapy session and making the connection into what many believe is a past life trauma, and by bringing that to light, many people are able to overcome phobias that, in the case of who you were speaking to earlier, a phobia of vermin, of mice, of reptiles, of heights, and many times, whether people subscribe to the idea that it is indeed past life memories that come out during these sessions, what you cannot dispute is really the ability for them to really cut down on or diminish fear of a whole variety of things.
Okay, so let's look at what happens in a past life regression or an intense feeling session, some of which we do here at my clinic. What happens is that a person does have a high catharsis, which means the amygdala gets flooded, but not only flooded, some of the higher cortical functions are brought in by the therapist. So that very thing does take place. And it is very true. I've seen it myself many times. A phobia can be undone by a regression, by a deep emotional or a cathartic experience of sorts. So I'm in agreement with you. Let me ask you, personally, if people are highly emotional with you, how do you feel about it?
For me, it's a case of, I think it has to be evaluated on a case-to-case basis.
Well, how about somebody who loves you?
Somebody who loves me? I would tend, being the sensitive, more on the sensitive scale, to engage them directly and try to, for better or worse, make bring some resolution.
Have you ever felt like pulling your hair out?
Yes.
Yeah, you know the feeling. I thank you very much for calling in, and thanks for your advice.
Absolutely. Thank
you. Bye-bye. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Yes, we've all felt like pulling our hair out at times. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with more exciting stuff. Bye-bye for now, my friends.